Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to see a good crowd here this morning. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm Deputy Director and Senior Fellow for the Energy and National Security Program. And it's really an honor to have with us Ambassador Dick Jones, who is the Deputy Executive Director at the IEA, as well as, let's see if I can get it pronounced right, Nicholas Rocky. Was that close?
Rake.
Marcus, I'm sorry. I can't read either. To present the latest energy technology perspectives publication by the IEA. And this is one of three or four kind of really flagship publications that the IEA puts out. Of course, they do short-term work with the monthly oil market reports, midterm reports, which we had the presentation of the natural gas and renewables midterm, and of course the World Energy Outlook is one of the other flagship publications. But the energy technology perspectives takes a bit of a different look at the energy futures that we have, and really takes a focus on the technology side and perhaps less on the market size, to look and see what is really possible and what's feasible and what is the state of play. It comes out every 2 years, correct? And so it's been our pleasure to have the last two presentations here, and so looking forward to having a good presentation this morning. We will be doing questions and answers at the end, so if you can write down your questions as we go through, we'll be able to take them then. So Ambassador Jones, if you'd like to get started.
Oh, okay.
Actually, Marcus will be starting.
I'll just launch a little video for you. That's a little intro to what we do.
Say very nice. It's a different IEA than the one that I knew before.
So. Yeah. Thank you very much, Marcus. I hadn't realized that the music was so annoying.
No.
But maybe that's.
You only got the treble though. The bass was gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. David. First of all, thank you very much for your introduction, and I just want to express my sincere gratitude to CSIS for organizing today's event. It's a real good opportunity for us to unveil the newest edition of the Energy Technology Perspectives 2012, as David pointed out. And I think this is a great venue for doing so, and I'm pleased with the turnout this morning. The IEA is launching this report at a critical time for the world's energy system. Midway through 2012, the challenges are clear. Energy demand and prices have been rising. Energy-related carbon dioxide, CO2 emissions, have hit record highs. Energy security concerns are at the forefront of the world's political agenda. All of these scores, ETP 2012 contains both good news and bad news for governments, industry, and citizens. The bad news is that the world is failing to tap technology's potential to create a clean energy future. But the good news is that we can turn affordable clean energy from aspiration into reality if we but tap that potential. ETP 2012 looks ahead all the way to 2050. It shows us three dramatically different futures. One, which we call the 2DS, or 2-degree scenario, where the rise in average global temperatures is held to 2 degrees scenario. One, where average temperatures rise by 4 degrees centigrade. And finally, a potentially devastating scenario, where they rise 6 degrees centigrade. The first path offers us the prospect of attaining the international goal of mitigating climate change by limiting the long-term increase in average temperatures worldwide to 2 degrees centigrade from pre-industrial levels. This is the pathway to sustainability. However, for us to have an 80% chance of reaching this target, energy-related CO2 emissions must be cut worldwide by more than half between 2009 and 2050. This two-degree ETP scenario also outlines the technologies, policies, and financing required to reach this goal. It provides tools and roadmaps which can guide our national policies towards a more sustainable future. And here I would like to stress that a sustainable future is not just about reducing carbon emissions. ETP 2012 shows us a more secure, affordable alternative to our current path, one where countries harvest more of their indigenous energy, enhancing their energy security, and creating lasting fuel savings that outweigh the cost of transitioning to a new lower carbon energy system. Indeed, the biggest challenge, as we see it, to achieving a low carbon energy future is not its absolute cost or its technological difficulty. Rather, it is agreement on how to share uneven costs and benefits of adopting clean energy technology across generations and geographically among countries in an equitable manner. To make a successful transition from today's rising CO2 emissions to a world where they are cut in half in less than 40 years, we need to take action urgently. Are we on the right track to make this transition? Simple answer is no. Under current policies, rather than failing, energy use and carbon dioxide emissions would actually increase by a third by 2020 and almost double by 2050. So instead of being cut in half, we're on a track to double the emissions. Progress in rolling out clean technologies has simply been too slow and too piecemeal. Investment in fossil fuel technologies continues to outpace investment in cleaner technologies. Too little is being spent on developing, demonstrating, and deploying clean energy technologies. In fact, the share of energy-related investment in public research, development, and deployment, RD&D as we call it, has fallen by two-thirds since the 1980s. Such failures to embrace the full potential of clean energy technology and improving energy efficiency are very alarming. And yet, there is still time to achieve a low-carbon energy system, one that is likely to enhance energy security, underpin stable economic growth, and safeguard the environment. Decisive, efficient, and effective policies can still unleash the full power of technology to create a sustainable future. Now, as I mentioned before, progress in rolling out clean energy has been too slow and piecemeal. In ETP 2012, we divided technologies into three categories to assess their performance. Some were on track. Some just require a bit more effort, but the majority were off track. Several of the most mature renewable technologies, like hydropower, the use of biomass, onshore wind, and solar PV, photovoltaic technology, are on track. Fuel economy, electric vehicles, and industry are improving, but more effort is needed in those areas. However, unfortunately, a number of vital technologies, cleaner coal, nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, efficient buildings, and biofuels for transport are simply off track. Let's be clear, while ambitious, a clean energy transition is still possible. However, action in all sectors will be necessary to reach the two-degree scenario targets. Indeed, progress in renewable power technologies has been quite positive. Hydro, biomass, wind, and solar PV are broadly on track to achieving the two-degree scenario goals, as I mentioned. In particular, wind has progressed impressively. In fact, with 27% growth rates, it is now the most competitive of renewable energy technologies. Solar PV has been growing even faster in recent years, but, of course, from a much smaller base. It's registered 42% average growth over the last decade. This growth has been driven by strong policy support in some countries and impressive cost reductions. Some countries have seen a 75% decrease in the cost of solar PV in just the last 3 years. And this is the installed cost. It's not just the cost of the modules. It's the cost of everything for installation. So it's a huge step forward for that technology in a very short time. Of course, maintaining such progress will not be easy. Enhanced research, development, and demonstration is still needed for refining new generation technologies that are not advancing quickly enough. Some of these include concentrated solar power or solar thermal. Offshore wind is another area. More mature renewable energy technologies must also continue to deploy to new markets with high resource potential. But just to repeat this book's high note, on the whole, renewable sources, particularly renewable sources of electricity generation, particularly wind and solar PV, are progressing quite well. While public RD&D hit a high in 2009, it's a little spike there towards the end of the right side, and this was a result of economic stimulus spending. You can see that it declined again in 2010 to just a little bit more than 2008 levels. Now, preliminary 2011 data suggests that spending may again be on the rise, which would be good news. But if you look at that graph, overall, the energy sector only accounts for about 4% of total government R&D spending, and it was 11% back in 1980. This weak support for energy R&D represents a major challenge, given the strategic importance of the sector. Coupled with continued measures aimed at fostering early deployment to provide opportunities for technology learning and cost reduction from, for example, economies of scale for more mature technologies, targeted RD&D efforts are crucial for bringing early-stage clean energy technologies to market. How can we overcome the obstacles on the road towards a clean energy future? ETP 2012 makes several recommendations on ways to transform our energy system. One key conclusion is that a sustainable energy system must be smarter, more unified, and integrated energy system. Today's system is centralized and one-directional. For example, power comes from a power plant to the consumers, goes in one direction. But tomorrow's system, however, will be decentralized and multidirectional. Complex and diverse individual technologies will need to work together rather than in isolation. This means that policies should be designed to address the needs of the energy system as a whole rather than individual technologies. In short, our success will hinge on adopting systems thinking, which is more efficient because it identifies synergies and opportunities for savings across sectors and applications. It also focuses fossil fuel use on those applications with the greatest intensity of energy use and emphasizes the efficiency of the service provided rather than just the amount of energy consumed. And here I just want to emphasize that when it comes to our energy mix, we believe there is plenty of space for fossil fuels in our future. What we're advocating is a more balanced system that makes us less reliant on them, but not in any stretch of the imagination do we think they can be eliminated. Now, ETP 2012 shows how investing in a transition to a clean energy future can pay off in many ways. There are three key recommendations for government policymakers from ETP 2012, which can help turn the dream of a cleaner energy future into reality. First, we need to ensure that energy costs reflect the true cost of energy. This means pricing carbon and abolishing fossil fuel subsidies. Fossil fuel subsidies, which in 2011 were at least 7 times higher than governmental support worldwide for renewables. This will help level the playing field for clean energy technology and improve the climate for market-driven investment in this area. And you can see here the first recommendation is to create an investment climate of confidence in clean energy. Second, governments at all levels should act to help unlock the incredible potential of energy efficiency by adopting our 25 energy efficiency recommendations, which were originally developed for the G8 but have been endorsed by IA ministers and others around the world. And they cover 7 different sectors. And third, we must accelerate energy innovation by increasing public support for research, development, and demonstration, RD&D, to encourage private sector investment and facilitate widespread commercial penetration of clean, modern technologies. So that's a brief overview from the top, and now I'll let Marcus take over and give you the nitty-gritty details.
Thanks. Morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm Marcus. So I'll drill down a little bit in the details of ETP. I am the project leader of ETP, so I've been spending the better part of the last year and a half on this project. So it's great to be out talking about the results rather than about what we intend to do. So zooming into the US, this graph here shows CO2 emissions dropping by about 75% in the US between now and 2050. At the bottom line there, that's a 2-degree scenario. That's a pathway that we set out in our 2DS. And then the wedges between there showed contributions from different sectors in achieving that scenario compared to the 4-degree scenario. And there are really two sectors that stand out for the US. First is power generation. That is the case in almost all countries, I would argue. And the second is transport, which is particularly large contribution in the United States. So I'm going to talk a little bit in particular about these two sectors. And if we start by looking at the electricity sector, this here you see the global picture. So this is how we envision the mix of fuels changing from 2009 to 2050 at the global level. And as you see, we have, first of all, we have a great increase in electricity demand, so almost a doubling of electricity demand globally. And second, the share of low-carbon technologies, and in particular renewable technologies, will be rising rapidly. So we can go from a situation today where about a fifth of the electricity is generated through renewable technologies to over half. So we have 57% renewable power generation in 2050 at the global level. So this brings us back to the message we heard Ambassador Jones touch on before, on the need to change the overall functionality of the system to accommodate all these new sources of power generation. I'll come back to that in a minute. If we look at the US situation a bit more closely, this is a slide that some of you might have seen a couple of weeks ago when our colleagues from the medium-term renewables team were here presenting our just-launched medium-term report for renewables, where we look 5 years into the future rather than 40. And what you see is the wind capacity growth in the US from 1998 through today, and then the red bars show our projections. And really the takeaway here is the effect of policy. And I've added a couple of arrows here showing what happened in the past as production tax credits expired in the US. And if you look at what we have, what we project for 2012 in terms of installed capacity, and then you look at next year, 2013, most of that crash is due to the expected expiration of the PTC, the production tax credits, at the end of this year. So this uncertainty policies is not unique to the US by any means, but so we see this pattern in many countries, but it just underlines the importance of some kind of certainty and predictability in particular as policy design for these new technologies. In the US, of course, we have a lot of portfolio standards at the state level that will support some of the growth that we see beyond 2013, but still at the federal level, we see great uncertainty. Natural gas is an interesting fuel from many respects. And here you see the projected growth that we have in the US for coal and gas. And it's certainly true that in the short term, or even the medium term, natural gas provides huge benefits, both from an economic standpoint and from an environmental one. When it displaces coal, as it to a large extent is doing here in the United States, the emissions reduction are impressive. We have reductions of CO2, but of course also other pollutants like sulfur and mercury. So the benefits are real and obvious. However, if you look at the long term, natural gas, the role of natural gas will change. And I'll just show you one slide to show you what I mean. What you see here is the CO2 intensity in in power generation at the global level and at different regional levels. So the line graph here shows how many grams of CO2 is emitted in the 2-degree scenario per every kilowatt hour of electricity between now and 2050. So as you see, we're going to go from a situation where we have about 500 grams of carbon for every kilowatt hour to way below 100 in 2050. And then the gray bands here in the middle of the graph shows the performance of two common kinds of natural gas fired power generation. Open cycle gas turbine, which is the top one, that's the most flexible, it's often used to balance a power system, and combined cycle gas turbine, which is the top performing in terms of CO2 and efficiency technology that we have on the market today. And as you see, somewhere around 2025 and 2030, on average, the CO2 intensity needs to be below what natural gas can provide, unless we deploy CCS. So at some point, natural gas, at least from this perspective, will go from being part of the solution to being part of the problem. And of course, this raises questions around how we invest in infrastructure for gas. If we really want to move to a very low carbon system, which is the 2-degree scenario, we're going to have to find a way to accommodate for decreased use of natural gas. So the power plants will run for fewer hours and provide more peak power rather than baseload and so forth. We're going to have to find ways of using some of the infrastructure for other fuels. It could be biogas or hydrogen in the future, unless we want to face the sunk costs in these infrastructure systems. So I think this is an important message to carry with you as we look at the role of natural gas. It's a nice segue to carbon capture and storage. You know, of course, this picture that I just showed you before could change if we can afford and if the progress on CCS is more is quicker than we expect in our scenario. So CCS could play a major role in accommodating more fossil fuels. However, and Ambassador Jones already mentioned this, the progress on CCS, as you probably know, is disappointing so far. We're not making the progress as we hoped only a few years ago. And we've indeed decreased the rate at which we deploy carbon capture and storage in our scenarios. However, we at the IEA still believe that CCS has got a large role to play, critical role to play. The potential is great. And I guess there are two main messages to take away from this picture. One is that we need to ramp up CCS rapidly. We need to step up, and particularly government efforts, to demonstrate CCS in power generation. We have quite a few good demonstration plants in industry, but so far no large-scale demonstration in power generation. So that's the first one. Second, CCS is not only about power generation, as many people believe. It's also about industry. In fact, in industry, CCS provides one of the few technologies beyond energy efficiency that could, in a significant way, reduce emissions. So without CCS, it becomes very difficult to get rid of the emissions in industry. In power, it's slightly different. We can see other solutions than CCS, but certainly it will become more costly, will put more pressure on other resources like biomass and so forth without CCS. Turning to transport, again, starting with a global picture, this is sales of cars, passenger light duty vehicles, at the global level between now and 2050, split by technology. So as you see, we're going to move, not surprisingly, from a system which is largely based on fossil fuels and internal combustion engines to one that where almost all cars that are sold in 2050 have some kind of electric motor into it. So we see room for different pathways in different countries. So not all countries will, of course, have all these technologies. It doesn't make sense to have infrastructure in place for all these powertrain technologies. But certainly there is room for different pathways at the global level. Looking at the policies and the targets for particular electric vehicles, that brings a few interesting observations to the forefront. So what we see here are the government targets for electric vehicle sales between now and 2020 when we add them up. So we've gone through all the country policy and the announced targets that countries have made for electric vehicles, and we've added them up. And this is actually quite encouraging. If these targets are realized, we're going to have about 20 million vehicles on the road by 2020, about 7 million vehicles sold in 2020. That's almost spot on what we have in our 2-degree scenario. So if we realize this, we're at the volumes needed to create the cost reductions. We can support the infrastructure that we need in the longer term and so on and so forth. However, when we talk to our industry partners, the car manufacturers that we work very closely with when we develop our modeling, the picture is slightly different. So this is what they plan to produce when we ask them. This is the planned installed capacity to produce electric vehicles in the same time period. So, of course, the discrepancy is quite striking. So industry is planning for about a fifth of the sales in 2020, as the governments are announcing targets for. Of course, industry is flexible; it could adjust. So maybe this slide is slightly pessimistic, overly so. But it's still true that it takes time for industry to build new factories. It takes time to get consumer confidence in place. So really, and this is a general message, not only for electric vehicles, it's really important that governments back up their targets with credible policies so that industry believes that it makes sense to invest in the production capacity, and the consumers believe that it makes sense to choose an electric vehicle over a conventional one. So I think this is a very important message to our policymakers. In the short term, although electric vehicles is maybe more interesting from an academic standpoint and sort of more spectacular, in the short term, in particular, fuel efficiency can play a huge role. And what you see in the left panel are the improvements of average fuel efficiency at the global level. The bottom, the blue line, shows where we need to go in the 2-degree scenario. And the green line there shows what you can achieve just by a better fuel economy. So that includes better fuel economy in conventional gasoline and diesel vehicles and hybrid vehicles. So it doesn't include electric vehicles, no plug-in hybrids, no hydrogen, no fuel cells. So as you see, we come a long way just with fuel efficiency. And to the right, you see those fuel efficiency improvements translated into fuel savings. So, of course, you could have a lot of arguments how you do these calculations. But just to give you an order of magnitude, every day this would save about 11 million barrels of oil globally every day just by fuel economy. However, this is not enough. As you see, we need to go further down than we have just by better fuel economy. And the answer to that is modal shift. So looking at the U.S. picture here, we just saw the global picture. Here's the U.S. And you see to the left the situation passenger mode share, so split by air, rail, buses, and cars in 2010 in the U.S. And as you see, it's mainly cars and airplanes. The 40S, that picture is largely unchanged. We have an increased demand for travel in general. We have an increased demand for air travel in particular. Through a better fuel economy, we could achieve what I just showed you before. But if we're going to go all the way to the 2DS, we need to shift some of the travel, in particular from cars to rail and buses. So that's the last remaining wedge there that I saw over and above. Of course, we can achieve with electric vehicles and hydrogen, for example. Turning to the building sector. It's certainly true that in almost all OECD countries, the building sector contains huge potential for energy efficiency. The challenges in the OECD in particular is that a lot of the buildings are already built, so it's all about refurbishments. And here you see, just to illustrate that fact, you see the growth in households projected between now and 2050. And so, as you see, that's almost flat, and that's a pretty good proxy for how many buildings we need to build. So a large portion of the buildings are already there, which has implications for what kind of policies would be effective to bring about, for example, improved efficiency buildings. If you look at the non-OECD world, the opposite is true. So here you see the number of households and the growth of number of households in non-OECD countries. So, of course, here the challenges are completely different in some respects. You know, it's about creating building codes for new buildings. It's about incentivizing system integration so that the people that inhabit these buildings have a way of being efficient that's currently not possible for us in the OECD world. So this is interesting when you look at what kind of policies could work in different contexts. Heating and cooling is a special feature of this year's edition of EGP. We certainly believe that heating and cooling has not received the attention it should get, especially compared to electricity. Not many people, or not enough people, I should say at least, realize that almost half of total demand for energy in the world is heating. So almost half of the energy we use is used for heating. Cooling is a smaller part, but what's interesting is that the latent demand for cooling is, we believe, is huge. When you look at the mega trends in the world right now, one is that most of the income growth and the population growth is going to happen in sunny and hot countries. And secondly, most of that growth is going to be in urban environments. And one of the first things that people tend to buy as they grow richer, and particularly if they're living in a city, is an air conditioning unit. And if we continue to use the kind of air conditioning that we have here in this country, and certainly most of the OECD, which is basically a fridge, that's going to create a huge increase in demand for energy just for cooling. So we need to change the way that we cool our buildings. You know, it could be everything from better architecture, the passive cooling system, solar thermal cooling, district cooling networks, and so forth. And certainly that's an area where we believe that, that we should keep a particular eye on what's happening in the cooling sector. Same is true for heating. You know, we have a lot of inefficient heating in industry. There's huge waste of heat. Power generation is probably the most obvious one, although we tend to forget about it. You know, more than half of the energy that we put into power generation is just wasted as heat. So we discard it into the atmosphere or cool it off in other ways. But also in industry, we could use some of the heat that goes out from one industry, could be picked up another, what's called cascading heat use, which could create quite large savings in the overall if we manage to integrate the system. That requires better coordination at the policy level and better planning among industry, which is a very steep challenge, it's got to be said. One particularly interesting development in the heating sector, and especially for buildings, is heat pumps, so electrifying heat. If we use heat pumps, which is basically a fridge run in reverse, where you pull heat from the ground or from the air, you add a little bit of electricity, and you save about 3/4 of the energy compared to if you burn natural gas or something else to provide direct heating. So that's a very efficient technology if used correctly. So we certainly have a large increase in the number of heat pumps used for heating in the residential sector. The flip side of that, though, is that it will create additional pressure, especially on peak demand for electricity. So if everybody wakes up in the morning and turn on their heat pump, peak demand in the morning is going to go through the roof. And here, I try to show that. The dark green graph there shows what would happen in a stylized system if people just ran their heat pump as they need it, basically. So you see sort of from midnight to the left, I've divided the day into 4 time slices. You see how that shoots up when people wake up in the morning and then again as they get home at night. Now, if you instead have some kind of fairly simple control system that evens out that demand, so we run the heat pumps a bit smarter, we might not wait until we wake up. We could have something automatic that turns it on just before we wake up. You could have a little bit of storage. You could have control of your appliances. Then you could shave about 30% off that peak demand, which might, at the individual level, might not mean so much, but there's a system level that's hugely important. It saves lots of money in terms of upstream capacity that otherwise would have to be built to supply that peak that you see to the left there. So I think we make a strong case in ETP that it's possible from a technology standpoint to realize the 2-degree scenario. The obvious question, of course, that we always get is how much is this going to cost? Is it feasible from an economic standpoint? And what we try to do in order to at least provide half an answer to that question is we add up all the investments needed in addition, in the 2-degree scenario, in addition to what's needed in a scenario where climate policy and energy efficiency is not a priority, so in the 6-degree scenario. And what we end up with is quite staggering numbers. So we would need about $36 trillion in addition invested in the energy system in the 2-degree scenario. That's a lot of money. But the good news is that if we add up the fuel savings that these investments would generate, the numbers are even greater. So the top bar here shows the additional investments needed. The middle green blue bar there shows the fuel savings that these investments could generate. Now, as you see, if on net, we have about a $60 trillion saving. And even if you discount that at 10%, which is a fairly high discount rate from a social planner's perspective at least, we still end up with a $5 trillion saving. So when we do this over time, we see that around 2025, or at least by 2030, the fuel savings have offset the additional upfront investment cost. So rather than focusing on the actual sort of precise numbers here, I think the takeaway here is it's very difficult, I would argue, to make the case that it's impossible to realize the 2-degree scenario from an absolute cost perspective. That is a very difficult argument to make. It's very difficult to say that it's impossible from a technology standpoint. However, the main barrier, or at least one of the huge barriers, is the fact that these costs and benefits are very unevenly distributed. So they're unevenly distributed over time. So it's not obviously the case that the people that need to put up the money up front will see the benefits. It's not necessarily the case that the countries that need to put in the investments will see the benefits. So these uneven distributions of these costs and benefits are, I think, the key to unlock. And that's why the role of governments and international collaboration is so important to realize the scenario. I'd like to close just by a little demo of a new feature of ETP. One of the first things that I did when I joined the IA and took over this project was we did a survey with our stakeholders and asking them what would be the most important value added for this project for you. And by far the most common answer was, well, the IA, I'm sure you do great analysis, but it's very difficult to understand what you do. So the transparency issue is a big one. And secondly, could it be possible to make the data available so we could use it and play with it ourselves? That would also be a great benefit. So what we've done now is try to address at least some of that concern. And I'll show you just one component of that, which is our new website. So there's two components of this. One is a data visualization tool. So this is all available. You can just go to the IA website and click your way to ETP. This is an effort from us to try and make the data more understandable for our users. So what you see here is a slightly messy picture. I'll try to make less mess in a minute, is the flow of energy and at the global level. And to the left, you have the input, the supply of fuels. You have coal, natural gas, biomass, and so forth. You have the transformation of those fuels in the middle, and then you have the end-use sectors to the right, so where those fuels go. So what you can do here is you can zoom in, for example, on the power and heat sector. So here you see the flows of energy that goes into power and heat, and then where that energy goes. I guess the striking here is all the losses that I talked about before, how a large part of the energy they actually just lost and wasted. You can zoom in on one particular sector, so choosing, for example, industry here. You can see where industry is getting its energy from. You can do this for different years. So here I actually show the 2050 situation, but you do this for our different time periods, so you can see how things change. You can zoom in, you can take one sector. So looking here at transport, in 2009, you see here where, for example, passenger travel gets its energy from. It's all oil, not surprisingly. And then you can see how this changes. So just playing this little movie here, you can see how the share of oil that goes into transport gradually decreases out to 2050. And all this is an attempt from us to make it more easy to understand what's behind this. And all the data behind this is downloadable, so you can just click here and get the data behind it. Another way of showing what we try and do in our scenarios is zoom in on the actual emission scenarios and what the contribution of different technologies could be to realize these. So here we're looking at the world. The top here you see emissions trajectory in the 6-degree scenario. So at the y-axis you have gigatons emissions of CO2. And then you can choose different technologies. Here I've chosen carbon capture and storage and renewable energy. If I add end-use energy efficiency, you see how the emissions drop. You can do this by sector. So if you click out the world and you choose United States instead, you see here the same picture, but for the United States. So you can choose here, well, I don't believe in CCS. I'll take that out, and you see how the emissions rise. So all this, we hope that this will form a better understanding and in the end, of course, better informed policymaking. We have a special feature on transport also. I won't show that now, but where you can just... you can look at the development of stocks of different vehicles and fuel efficiency and so forth between now and 2050. And for those of you who are lucky enough to have the book, you also have a little password there that you can go in and to another area of the website. You can download all the figures and all the data behind the graphs and the publication, play around with it yourself. So that's an effort to increase the transparency. So I hope that gives you an idea of what we're trying to do. And with that, I hand over to David again. Thanks.
Thank you, Marcus. That's a great presentation, and I think the tools you're showing at the end are really an important benefit from this work, because it does help to visualize and to actually begin to work with it for people who really want to understand more deeply. And I think it's a great way to add access to the IEA and for the IEA to be making it available to the world. So, Ambassador Jones, that's great. So we have a few ground rules, which most of you know, I'm sure, in terms of our question and answer sessions, is that we'd like you to identify yourself when you stand up. And if possible, if you can end up with a question and the way you ask it, it's always helpful. If you have a statement to make, you might end just with an inflection at the end to say, am I right or not? I was going to start, though, with a question, because I think one of the most, given the debate that's been going on here about whether or not we can afford to make the transformation, and that's really been dominating the debate, I think your numbers at the end on the investments versus fuel savings as well as the discount rates are very striking. And I was just wondering if you'd elaborate a little bit more on sort of how those fuel savings, that aspect of it is derived. Is it through the efficiency side, or is it through different price trajectories that result from the transformation?
They come from both, I should say. You know, the fuel savings, the end-use efficiency is hugely important. You know, I showed the case for transport, but the same is true is true in industry and power generation, where you know the end-use efficiency improvements in building sector creates large savings in the upstream part of it. So, you know, a large chunk of those savings are just through energy efficiency. What I didn't talk about were the price assumptions behind that. That's obviously very important. So we, in fact, in that slide I showed, we assume the same price levels in both scenarios. So we have and the oil price going in the 6-degree scenario from today's levels up to about $150 a barrel. We assume the same price development in the numbers that I showed you before. So we would pay the same money for oil in the 2-degree scenario, which obviously is not very realistic. As we reduce demand, we're likely to see a reduced price level of oil as well, and also other fuels. And in fact, if you add, you know, we've done projections what would happen to those prices as demand falls. And if you add that in, the fuel savings actually jump another 50%. Because not only do we buy less fossil fuels or other fuels, we also pay less for the fuel that we actually buy. Of course, this is driven by policy to a large extent. You know, the cost reductions that we're seeing in technology are driven by policy, but also there needs to be a price, and particularly on carbon, that safeguards against some of the rebound effects that we otherwise have. But, you know, to put it very simply, we're going to pay more for our own technology development, and some could also be some more to our governments, rather than shipping money to the oil and gas exporting countries overseas. So that's sort of a large change in these scenarios.
Thanks. Okay, well, open it up. We do have microphones, so if you can wait till the microphone gets to you, and let me start here on the left and we'll work my way over. So we'll do here in the front first and then behind.
Hi, Amy Jordan, Aramco Services. My question, I guess I was curious, a lot of the 2-degree scenario I would think would depend on getting governments to enact these policies. And I guess I was just curious, how close are we to a cutoff date, to being unable to get on the 2-degree scenario? Or do you think that, you know, if we miss the first one, can we get on it later? Or I guess that's my question.
Well, that's a good question. It's primarily a political question, obviously. It is true that the longer we delay, the more expensive it becomes, because you get a lot of lock-in. In our World Energy Outlook, we talked about that the lock-in could occur as early as 2017. But I'm not sure that's necessarily the be-all and end-all, because that assumed that once a coal plant is built, it runs. And what we've seen in the United States is, with the change in relative prices between coal and natural gas, a lot of coal plants have stopped running. So just because you've made an investment doesn't necessarily mean you're locked in. But it is getting very, very, very difficult to make the scenarios add up the longer we wait.
Yes, thank you. Kevin Massey with the Brookings Institution. Thank you for the presentation. And as always, I applaud the IEA's work. in at least laying out the ground, the landscape for policymakers. What I'm struck by is the dissonance between the issues that you are outlining in these presentations and the reality, especially here in the US, given the hydrocarbon resurgence in this country. It's very difficult to see how these kinds of policy decisions, this kind of leadership in policymaking is going to happen in the current environment where economic considerations are paramount, where oil and gas is abundant. So my question is, to what extent is the US hydrocarbon resurgence going to really derail any attempts at getting to the 2-degree scenario and maybe even to the 4-degree scenario?
One of the points that we make about, of course, the resurgence in natural gas is that it's already driving down emissions. Now, it is true that our analysis shows that at some point natural gas becomes, as Marcus said, part of the problem rather than part of the solution. But that's a good 20 years from now. And one thing I've noticed is that over time, policies and politics change. And I wouldn't rule out that it can change in the United States. We'll see. Obviously, this is we have an election coming up, and that will determine a lot of what happens with the policies. But that's one of the reasons why I emphasized at the outset that we don't say that you have to move out of fossil fuels completely. We do see a need for fossil fuels. And I would say that the important thing about the U.S. hydrocarbon resurgence is it's improving U.S. energy security. We think that if you invest in the lower carbon technologies, you can improve the energy security further. And the question is, what do you think the balance of the costs is, which is cheaper? Because there are external costs from burning the hydrocarbons. So we believe that the U.S. Resurgence at this time is good for the United States. It's good for energy security. And we also believe that investing more in renewables will be good for energy security. So we don't see that there's necessarily a trade-off. And also, as important as the world is, it's not the growth in energy demand and use in the United States that's really driving the 6-degree scenario. It's really growth outside the United States, in China, in India, and so on, because those are huge countries that are developing very quickly and are increasing their electrification. And it's burning of coal for electricity that is really the big problem. So, there may be some slowdown in the United States, but we don't think it's a game killer, if that's a proper phrase. You want to add anything, Marcus?
Well, I can just maybe in the United States in particular, we follow closely whether this notion of is natural gas killing renewables, and we don't really see that yet. At least we see some crowding out of the financing in particular. So when we look in the short term, when we hear some of the industry people saying, well, actually the money is not going to renewables anymore because it's going to gas. But that's more of a crowding out of the financing aspect rather than natural gas being bad for renewables. In fact, natural gas, through its flexibility, could support more renewable generation and particularly variable generation in the short term. So, it's a fair question to raise. And certainly, as I try to show, when you look at the 4-degree scenario, I didn't show that, but if you look at that, we have a continued rise in natural gas use. So the change in natural gas is very obvious when you look at the difference between the 4 and the 2. And that's simply, because what I just showed, that natural gas is a very good fuel when you replace coal, but at some point we need to go even lower.
Will Cole, Johns Hopkins. Wanted to ask about the role of nuclear power in this new version of the ETP. And sort of how you see that share going forward globally after Fukushima.
Nuclear power, of course, is very sensitive in many countries, including our member countries. It's an issue that's dividing a lot of countries. So the view on nuclear is very political. What's interesting after Fukushima is the position on nuclear has not really changed a lot in the countries where we, before Fukushima, saw the major growth being, you know, Russia, China, Korea are the most important ones. So in our scenarios, there is slightly less nuclear than we had in the previous edition, but the difference is not dramatic, as some people might expect. You know, we've certainly taken out some of the growth and we've taken into account the changing positions of Germany, Japan, and Switzerland, and so forth. But really, when you look at the overall picture, we still see that nuclear could play an important role in a low-carbon system. Of course, it's up to every country to weigh the benefits and the costs of nuclear. And, you know, we have a lot of people have problems, I think, financing nuclear just because it's very expensive in many countries to get the finance into place. So without governed policies to also address that, it's difficult just from that aspect to get nuclear growing. But again, we still have quite a bit of nuclear in the ETP scenarios. I think it provides about a 10% of the reductions to the 2-degree scenario.
But that's 10% from the 4 degrees.
Yes.
Because it's 20% reduction from the 6 degree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other point I'd make is that, as Marcus said, we haven't seen a big impact. In fact, electricity generated from nuclear power was only down 4% from after Fukushima. So we're just not seeing a big change. The key countries for investment in nuclear power are China, India, Russia, and Korea, and none of them have changed their policies.
Shift over here to the right side. So, Mallory, you can be the mic here, and then followed by Christian here.
Good morning. My name is Gaudet Bhagat from National Defense University. Ambassador, I understand you served for a long time in the Middle East and many countries in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others are working on nuclear and renewable. If you were to advise them, I understand energy security, diversification of energy mix, but which one do you think they should invest more? And do you see any regional approach instead of national? Thank you.
The short answer is I would advise them to invest in energy efficiency. Because right now, particularly in Saudi Arabia, their electricity consumption is growing at such a high rate, and they are currently using oil to produce electricity, that I think the estimate is in about 20 years they would be consuming all their oil domestically. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. The Saudis aren't going to sit there and wait and watch their oil revenues go down. So what is happening? In fact, they are mounting very serious campaigns for energy efficiency in Saudi Arabia. You can no longer, for example, get your house certified, or you can't get your electricity connected to your house unless you have a certification that you've actually installed the required insulation for the house. I mean, that's a big step forward. We're working with the Saudis on this. They're focusing on buildings. They're focusing on transport as well. So the Saudis are already taking steps. You mentioned they're looking at renewables as well, particularly solar power. If they've got abundant oil, they've got even more abundant sunshine in Saudi Arabia. It's not perfect sunshine because there is a lot of dust in the atmosphere, so I'm not sure the insulation is as good as in some other countries, but it's pretty good, and they're investing in solar desalination, for example. A lot of the electricity today is consumed in desalinization, so they want to do that. And if they want our advice on that, we'll be happy to give it. But I was in Saudi in December, and I saw some of the research they're doing on solar energy, and it's first-rate research. So I'm cautiously optimistic that the Saudis are moving in the right direction on these issues. On nuclear, I think nuclear raises a lot of concerns. I don't think that the Saudis, although they've announced intentions to go nuclear, I'm not sure that they'll follow through on that if they can come up with, if some of these other avenues bear fruit. And I think personally that would be probably a good thing because I know that that would be a sensitive political issue for many countries to see Saudis investing in nuclear. UAE is investing in nuclear. They've cleared some of the hurdles. They've already decided to purchase 4 nuclear power plants from Korea, and that those plans are on track. I think that we'll see how that goes, and that will influence what happens in Saudi. In terms of regional, the regional cooperation doesn't seem to be a strong suit for the peninsula, but it is getting better. I mean, there are talks of having regional grid and so on. And I know that in addition to the Saudis, the Kuwaitis are looking more at energy efficiency these days. So I think there is some potential, but I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't include it in our models just yet.
Am I on? Daryl Beshin at Energy and Conservation Renewable Energy. Good to see you guys again. And I appreciate the new toy. Perhaps we can link up toys. That might be a good idea so folks can flow back and forth. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. So here's the question. If the growth is going to happen in China and India, and they are taking a very aggressive national domestic economic growth policy for themselves, what is our play for capital and technology in the developed nations to capitalize on that growth? My question clear to you? So what's my competitive advantage? What's our competitive advantage that we can use to enter that market, viz. Their national economic policy advisors are going, hey, if we're going to grow and use energy, let's skip a generation, use new technology, and produce it ourselves. So it's sort of a question as you're looking at that's where growth is. Think about the economic opportunity or needs or directions that might be most opportune for the industrially developed technology nations. That's the question. If that's a question.
Well, that's a difficult question, I think, to answer. I think you put the finger on an interesting fact, though, is that a lot of these what used to be considered as renewable policies or climate change mitigation policies is moving towards being industry policy. And we certainly see that, you know, the solar industry, I think, is very, you know, probably the most dramatic example where a lot of the policies were introduced using the argument that we're going to create a new industry. And now we see that a lot of that industry is, in fact, shifting. So it's shifting from Germany, United States, to China, in this case of solar PV. So, you know, I don't have a good answer, I guess, is my answer to how we could, what is the niche of the US or Europe, you know, to make sure that we capitalize on these investments. That's a billion-dollar question, I think. But it's certainly true that we capitalize on some of the changes also. Although, you know, some of the companies that now go belly up, and, you know, in the OECD, and that's sad because I think it's not only about creative destruction. There's also some very good companies that go under right now because the financial constraints and so forth in the short term are killing them. But we also see some of the benefits. You know, Ambassador Jones talked about the reduced cost of solar PV. Some of that is just because we have, you know, learning and also reduced cost and production for the modules. And we wouldn't see that if we didn't have those great markets. You know, we see the greatest growth in terms of absolute additions are not in the OECD, it's in China and India. So without those big markets, we couldn't see those cost reductions. So no matter where those panels are produced, we're dependent on those markets to get the cheap energy also in our part of the world. So I guess that's at least half an answer.
Yeah. Well, I'll try and add a little bit to that. I mean, you've certainly seen, for example, that China was one of the biggest beneficiaries of the feed-in tariff that was introduced in Germany for solar. The goal was, or the thought was, oh, we'll jumpstart the industry in Germany, and they did jumpstart the installation industry, but they jumpstarted the Chinese photocell business because the Chinese had the vision to invest in a very large scale. So they got the economies of scale, and they, you know, basically most of the solar panels that were installed in Germany were actually made in China. But having said that, installation is a large part of the economic benefit for a country in moving in this direction. So the Germans probably got their share. And of course, as Mark has pointed out, I mean, those countries, China and India, are the ones who we want moving in this direction, because they are the ones that if they stay on their current path are going to be burning lots and lots of coal. And that's the real problem, as I said, for the emissions.
I was going to take a little tangent, Dick, if it's okay, because this really begs a question that we talk about a lot, but I would be interested in your perceptions of where we stand. That every presentation we're now seeing emphasizes more and more the role of developing countries who are not members of the IEA versus those members who are members of the IEA. And it really, I think the latest thing that struck me was we had the midterm projections, which, again, China dominated almost everything. In this case, China dominates as well. But in last week in the OMR that came out, projecting for the first time oil consumption in non-OECD countries was going to be passing quarterly, and then I think in 2013, passing for the year. So I think the trend is well established now. But I was wondering where you stand in figuring out how to bring effective communication and bring those countries to the table for the kind of work you're doing here, especially this longer-term work where you've done really in-depth thinking about the energy technology futures, but trying to get them to also bring the right people to the table. Mm-hmm. So sorry for the digression, but I think it's important.
No, it's a very good question, David. And the answer is we're doing quite a bit. More than we realize. In fact, more than I can probably recall off the top of my head. But one of the most encouraging things that's crossed my desk recently, that's new work that we've done, is we're helping China to design their emissions trading system. The Chinese are seriously, in their current 5-year plan, looking at introducing an emissions trading system. And so we sat down and said, okay, China isn't exactly a market economy. How do you design an ETS in the Chinese framework? And we've done that, and we've presented it to the Chinese, and they apparently, by all accounts, are quite pleased with it. And we've also worked with them on clean coal. We're working with them on carbon capture and storage. And the Chinese do have projects that they have contracted for carbon capture storage for power plants. They're one of the few countries in the world that is actually moving forward with an investment in CCS and in a coal-fired power plant. So it's not all bad news. And they're not the only country we work with. I mean, we're working with India. India is particularly a leader on energy efficiency. We're working with them also on emergency response. So they're very much concerned about the security aspects. And I could go down the list. We have about 7 of these major consuming countries, including countries in Latin America like Brazil and Mexico, South Africa, Indonesia, that we're working with besides China, India, and Russia. Yeah.
Now, I want to make sure there's nobody over here that I can't see. Okay, so let's start. I haven't done the middle very much. So in the middle, we have one here and then
someone
one behind. Okay, and then we'll get to the back.
Hi, Michael Ratner with Congressional Research Service. How do you convince, it was pointed out earlier that we're in an election year in the United States, how do you convince the public that this is a crisis? Because you don't hear the campaigns talking about it, it doesn't seem to come up, and so is the general public being educated on this, or is the role just to educate the governments?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we do books like this and why we come from Paris to make presentations to public forums. We don't just talk to the governments. But I think that whatever we do in the IEA, Mother Nature has demonstrated this spring and summer in the United States that it has a lot more power than the IEA does. I think, you know, looking at record heat, record drought in the United States, I would expect it will have some impact. Depends on whether or not people can come up with convincing political ads on it, I guess. But we're continuing to do our work the best we can. You want to add anything, Marcus?
Well, I guess of course, that's, again, it's a very good question. And I think a challenge for policymakers, obviously we work mainly with policymakers, not so much with direct consumers and citizens, if you wish. But I think that a challenge for policymakers, a lot of the ones that we talk to, at least, they understand this. They know the problem is there. But it's very challenging for a politician to talk about benefits that lie 20, 30 years into the future. I think that's the key. You know, the policymaker and community needs to have the courage and the ability, to be frank, to explain to their voters and the electorate why this is important. And I don't think scaring people will work, which is why we try and show in different angles why this could be beneficial, and not just sort of scary if you don't do anything. But I think that's it's an important challenge for policy to try and explain that and to insert that into the political debate, although that is very difficult.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Cohn. I'm from Mitsubishi Nuclear Energy Systems. First of all, I want to say this looks like an excellent tool. I look forward to looking at it in some more detail. So I've seen several projections, including the EIA, the IAEA, and now the IEA reports. And each of them show a measurable but somewhat small contribution from nuclear power over the next 40 years. I was just wondering if you could comment on whether or not that's definite or whether there's some variation there, or what role you think developing nuclear technologies might change that picture.
The way we do the analysis is that we basically have a cost optimization routine. So we have a long list of technologies, and then our analysis focuses on how to use these technologies to meet a given demand for energy at the least cost. So what costs we assign to these technologies and how we project those costs to develop into the future becomes very important for what you see in the scenarios. So our underlying assumptions on nuclear, for example, will govern how much nuclear you see in the scenarios. So, I think obviously that raises the question, well, how accurate are our projections? And I think, we do our job as best as we can, but we certainly also see that our assumptions change. You know, we try and predict and follow, and together with industry partners, have as good assumption as possible. And in the case of nuclear, I think, one of the interesting trends, and I'm sure you know lots more about this than I do, is, what if the size of the reactors were to go down so we could deploy smaller-sized nuclear reactors that could replace, existing power plants of, say, 400 megawatts instead of the gigawatt size? That would open up new markets, I think, and if we could bring down the costs of those reactors, that would open up markets in other countries than we currently have in our scenarios. However, that doesn't take into account all the other concerns that people have around nuclear, with safety and proliferation and so on. But that's the kind of technology development that we see could change this picture beyond just the politics and how countries themselves view the costs and benefits of nuclear.
Yeah, these are the so-called small modular reactors.
Yeah. James Warner with the Fuel Cell and Hydrogen Energy Association. I just wanted to return to a question that was asked a couple back about the best arguments to make in a political context, which, the politics is really crucial. You have some of the slides up there, distributed generation and so forth. We may have the technology to do it, but the policies to implement it are still necessarily not there. There is a large portion of the electorate and of the folks who represent them that don't see reducing, at least in the United States, at least for now, that don't see reducing greenhouse gas emissions as a significant policy driver. That may change with weather events and so forth, but let's say it's not going to change dramatically in the next 5 years or so forth. You also have that same population which may buy back energy R&D deployment is anathema. And not just on one side of the aisle or the other. For example, with hydrogen infrastructure deployment, that's been a very difficult thing to get done here in the United States. And actually, in the United States, having any kind of a centrally designed deployment schedule is a difficult thing to do. So what's your best argument to the folks here in D.C., if you can't make it based on reducing emissions, if you can't make it necessarily based on that we should just spend a lot of money in energy R&D, we can agree that we should use less oil. That's about the only thing I think we can agree on both sides. But what's the best argument that we can use?
Well, I don't know the best argument. The best argument depends on your on who you're talking to. You have to be flexible in your arguments. But we do emphasize they're not just the environmental or the climate benefits. We emphasize energy security from diversification. But we also emphasize the economic benefits. Now, Marcus talked about positive return on the investment because of the fuel savings. But there are other ways to look at it too. For example, price volatility is an issue, and again, that's a concern for some people. And the nice thing about renewables, because they don't use fuel, their prices are pretty fixed once you do the investment. The price is primarily the capital cost of repaying the investment, and that's a very predictable cost. So there is a benefit to the economy in having a predictable cost. I personally feel that if you're a utility and you sit down and you think about your portfolio of power generation from as a portfolio in the financial sense, that even though it may be more expensive today, that you would want to include a certain proportion of renewables in your in the mix of your generation portfolio, precisely because it is less volatile than fossil fuels. So those are some of the arguments that I would try and use. But whether or not it's which one is the best, I don't know.
Could I just add, given your affiliation, we have a special focus, a special chapter on hydrogen in this year's ETP. And one interesting, I think, analysis that we do is looking at the infrastructure cost and how much it would add. And this is, I guess, a general, not only for hydrogen, but also for electric vehicles, all the infrastructure around using more hydrogen or electricity for transport, for example, is important, charging stations or distribution of hydrogen. It's a difficult situation because somebody needs to take the first upfront cost. But if you look at, and that's not negligible, but if you look at the proportion, between that cost and how much we're paying for example, vehicles, it's a tiny fraction. It's less than 1%. So, again, the absolute cost is not the major barrier. It's how we distribute and how we incentivize that first infrastructure development to enable people to choose, electric vehicle or fuel cell vehicle, for example.
Georgetown Climate Center. So I think your two headline recommendations were elimination of fossil fuel subsidies and pricing carbon. And it seems to me that the prospects for those for implementing those on a global basis don't look great, both for domestic political reasons, individual countries, and because of the collective action problem with a global externality. And so my question is, do you have a theory for political change for how we're likely to get there, and do you agree with that assessment?
Admittedly, it is difficult to make these changes, but as I mentioned, China is looking very seriously at an emissions trading system. The European Union already has one. Even some states in the United States have them. So, as difficult as it is from a U.S. domestic level, this notion is gaining traction around the world. Australia, for example, is in the process of implementing a system. So I wouldn't necessarily say that this is not happening. And on the fossil fuel front, a number of countries have tried to reduce subsidies. It's not been successful in many countries, I agree. I think one of the points that we advocate, though, is if you're going to change fossil fuel subsidies, put an alternative system in place first before you eliminate the subsidies. What I mean here, for example, one of the criticisms that I think everyone can agree with on fossil fuel subsidies is they're not very efficient for achieving their announced goals. For example, the whole idea behind fossil fuels is, it's to help the poor people in the country. Well, most of these countries that have large fossil fuel subsidies, the poor aren't the ones that are benefiting from them. It's the middle class and the rich, because they're the ones that have the cars, for example. So what we often say to people is, if you want to help the poor, subsidize public transportation. That's what they use. Or, you know, develop a system which targets people by income, things like that. And put these alternative systems in place before you eliminate the subsidies. Because what happens is that people see that you're eliminating subsidies, and they don't believe that you're going to put in anything to replace it. And then it's easy for people then to stir up the poor. So if you have a combination where you say we're trying to reform subsidies, we're trying to increase their efficiency, and so on, and you start introducing new programs, that is the way, personally, I think that we can get more countries to phase out the large amount of subsidization.
Okay, we're getting close to running out of time, so if I can get an idea of how many more questions, and we can maybe gather them up for this round. So why don't we do maybe here, Joe, and then to this on the right. Okay, and I guess we'll take four together, and then hopefully they'll be easy to answer.
Okay.
Good morning, Philip Brown with the Congressional Research Service. I found your fuel savings versus investment requirements analysis to be quite compelling, and it sort of suggests that those types of investments may be made on fundamental economics alone. But I also noted that you mentioned that these investments are dependent on the support of certain government policies, and I wanted to see if you could elaborate a bit more on the intersection of government policy and those investments.
Joe Dukert, I'm an independent energy analyst, and in my writings for many years, I've always emphasized time as a factor in policy that's underplayed. Now, your investment, as you describe it, has to be front-loaded, but it's hard to find an economist or a politician who foresees global economic stability, much less resumption of normal growth, before 2014, which is not the same as 2012. And if 2017 is a very important factor, have you factored that into your report? Given an almost certain delay of a couple of years in accepting your principles and the roadmap you described.
Tamar Hallerman with Exchange Monitor Publications. Going off the issue of pricing carbon, you mentioned how China's moving forward on a system, but what if other rapidly developing countries like India, South Africa, Brazil, what if they don't move forward on putting a price on carbon? Is the 2DS scenario impossible at this point?
And then Mallory, we'll collect one more question, which was the person in the back, all the way in the back.
Zach Bays, Department of Energy. You touched on this a little bit when you were discussing the residential heat pumps. I was wondering, particularly in the developing country context of Russia, India, of China that you spoke about, the role of demand-side load optimization as it might play into some of your scenarios.
Okay, I think that's a good range of final questions. So if you guys...
just briefly on your question, it's a good one. Well, of course, we assume reduced cost of some of the technologies. And if you take solar PV and wind as two examples, where we've actually seen the cost falling very sharply, that wouldn't have happened if there weren't policies in place to drive first the basic R&D and then at a later stage is the commercialization deployment of those technologies. We need to see that happening also for other technologies that are deployed later in our scenario. So hydrogen, you know, we talked about before is one example, but concentrated solar power is another. So without those policies in place, we won't have the technologies at the cost we need them to be to realize the scenario. So that's, I guess, the intersection. So we don't just assume that, well, does this make economic sense? We can just sit back and hope that it happens by itself. We need some kind of strategic policy direction and the vision from the policy side to realize these scenarios.
Okay, with respect to Joe's question, the simple point to make is that the scenarios are dependent on the growth on a growth assumption, and if you have weaker economic growth, you also then get weaker consumption of energy and weaker emissions. So you do get some benefit, so to speak, of slow growth. It's not only just slowing down your investment; it's also slowing down the growth in emissions. I mean, this is what we saw particularly in 2008. And the 2017 figure I mentioned, that was last year's World Energy Outlook, and we had significantly higher growth assumptions in that outlook than we're looking forward at the current time. So I'm hoping that maybe we'll get a little bit of a respite there. If you want to answer.
And well, and the delay question there is what we're trying to do, of course, is we factor in some of the inertia in the system when we develop our scenario. So we don't just let the model sort of run free and say, well, we could deploy, you know, lots and lots and lots of solar PV next year just because our assumptions show that it would be cost effective. So there's some constraint in how quickly you can change the system. Whether we do that accurately or not, you know, that's for others to decide. But we try and factor that inertia in.
Yeah, and in fact, in recent years, solar in particular has grown much more rapidly than our assumptions would have highlighted. Pricing of China, of carbon outside of China, we do have certain assumptions on how the emissions trading systems are introduced, at least in the WIO. I assume there is in the ETP as well, and in those assumptions, for example, India is not required to implement. It's interesting. India today is one of the few countries that doesn't have to reduce emissions between now and 2050. In fact, Indian emissions, according to our scenarios, are allowed to grow by 30%. Yeah, 35%. So it is a different situation in India. India is much less developed in many ways. The Indian industry is much less developed than Chinese industry today. And so there are differences between the countries. And, you know, the other countries are so small compared to China. China is really where we have to concentrate, just because of the sheer number of people, the sheer volume of their growth. And India is important, but India, you know, like I say, the models show that Indian emissions per capita are such that they can actually afford to grow, and we expect they will grow.
So to the last question, before that, I just mentioned Chinese emissions need to fall by about a half, so we need to cut them in half between now and 2050 in our scenarios. And if that doesn't happen, well, there's no way we could reach the 2DS. So if China doesn't move at all, and the same is true for India, if they just follow the current policy trajectory, it's just no way we can make it. Yeah, we're in trouble. Demand side optimization, it's nice to finish on a technical note. The demand side is hugely important. You know, we talked about flexibility before. You know, how do we integrate all this variable generation and intermittent generation from solar and wind? And that is true in all countries, including developing countries. And demand side management, so if we could just make it possible and incentivize people to change the demand pattern a little bit and industry to respond more effectively, that could provide a huge proportion of that flexibility that we need. In fact, when we do an analysis, we see that only demand side could provide almost all the flexibility under optimal conditions. So that's without taking into account, you know, upstream flexibility from natural gas or smarter grids, or, you know, all the smarter grids could enable more demand side response, of course. But so you know, the answer to your question is demand side is important in all countries, including developing countries.
Great. Well, thank you, Dick and Marcus. It was an excellent presentation and great work with all the questions. I think everyone has had a chance to ask something. And again, thank you very much for coming. And this is a great piece of work. Join me in thanking them.